On Valentine's Day, 2015, 27-year-old Erica Alonzo went out with her boyfriend in Orange County, California. She told her sister she would see them later that night, but Erica never came home. Weeks later, she was found deceased in a remote area of Orange County. Her body had been wrapped in plastic bags and secured with duct tape. Despite those circumstances, detectives said they did not believe Erica had been murdered. That statement has been questioned by many, and more than 10 years later, Erica's family and community are still trying to figure out what happened on that Valentine's Day night. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. And each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe we can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. So Erica Alonzo's case may be familiar to some of you. This investigation has been covered by much larger platforms like Kendall Ray and Crime Junkie. So you may be asking yourself, well, Derek, why are you covering it then? That's not normally what you do. Yes, we do sprinkle a few known cases in there, and we'll continue to do that. Every case deserves to be solved. But with this one, I know that these other channels have covered it, and from what I've gathered, there hasn't been much movement. And maybe I'm just getting a little cocky here, but I really believe in the community that we're building. I brag about you guys all the time. I refer to you as my part-time detectives. And I don't know. I just feel like the group of people that are coming to this show are really motivated and dedicated to solving these cases. They're not just about hearing the story. So even though we're like the little engine that could, we're a much smaller channel at this point. I just got a lot of faith in us. And I feel like even though there may be some overlap, we have a very great community here. And I wanted to do what we could to get this ball rolling again, because although we don't know exactly what happened here, there's definitely more information that hasn't been disclosed and people out there who know what those answers are that we're looking for. And yet they're kind of just skating by right now. And personally, it just bothers me. It doesn't sit well with me. I don't like it. And I'm not just going to read the case and then put it on my desk and not do something about it. So I need your help. Just like always, we're going to cover the case. I'm going to talk about it, give my opinions on it, but then I really want to hear your opinions as well. We got a lot to cover. I don't want to waste any more time. Let's dive into this week's case. Erica Alonzo was born on March 26, 1987, to her parents Isaac Sr. and Margarita Alonzo. She grew up in the Los Angeles County area as the third of six children in a large, tight-knit family. Those who knew Erica described her as someone who always seemed to be smiling. Even if she was dealing with something difficult, she didn't show it. Instead, she kept her struggles to herself and presented a happy exterior. Erica had a wide circle of friends. She was outgoing and deeply trusting, sometimes, according to her family members, a little too trusting. Her brother told the Orange County Register, quote, "She befriended everybody. She never really put up any barriers." By 2014, Erica was 27 years old and living with her parents in Laguna Hills. She spent time with her siblings and their children and remained closely connected to her family. And she had plans for her future. She wanted to return to school, and she hoped to one day become a mother. Around that same time, Erica was in a relationship with a man named Larry. He was nearly 20 years older than she was, and multiple reports described the relationship as on-again, off-again, toxic, and abusive. Erica's sisters later said they saw red flags. They described Larry as controlling and belittling. They tried to intervene, but Erica always saw the best in people. Things took a turn for the worse on November 2, 2014, when a neighbor witnessed the fight between Erica and Larry outside. According to reports, the argument escalated to the point where the neighbor called the police. When officers arrived, Larry reportedly had a scratch on his face, so Erica was arrested and charged with misdemeanor domestic violence and corporal injury. And because of this charge, there was a protection order put in place, and Erica was ordered to stay away from him. To this day, it's not entirely clear what happened during this altercation. The neighbor who contacted the police later told CBS, quote, "They were outside in the street and it looked abusive. It looked like something bad was going on, so I called the police. When I looked out the window, he looked perfectly fine. I really can't say what happened that night, but I remember hearing a lot of screaming." The neighbor added that she believed Erica appeared to be intoxicated, but Erica's family maintained that she was protecting herself against Larry that night. Before the end of the year, Erica asked the court to postpone her case, and the request was granted as long as Erica met certain conditions, including attending alcohol dependency counseling sessions. Then, on February 6, 2015, Larry dropped the domestic violence charge against Erica. The restraining order was also lifted. According to her family, Erica and Larry were in communication again, and they were discussing getting back together. 8 days later, on February 14th, Erica told her family that she was going out to lunch with Larry, and that night, she went out with him again. She sent a message to her sister Patty telling her that she would be home later that evening, but Erica never returned. When she didn't come back and stopped answering her phone, Patty was concerned. Erica was known for staying in contact, and it wasn't like her to disappear without responding. Patty began calling Erica's friends to see if anyone had seen or heard from her, but unfortunately, no one had. So finally, she decided to call Larry. We're going to talk about what he had to say right after this break. Ever wake up sweaty, freezing, or just uncomfortable? The temperature in your bedroom can make or break your sleep. And that's why I switched to Miracle Made Sheets. They're inspired by NASA technology and use silver-infused temperature-regulating fabric to help you sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. So if you're a hot sleeper, cold sleeper, doesn't matter, these sheets are designed to keep you in your comfort zone so you have a great night's sleep. And thanks to their antibacterial silver technology, Miracle Made Sheets stay cleaner and fresher up to 3 times longer than regular sheets, which means fewer odors, fewer wash cycles, and way less laundry. And the most important part, at least in my opinion, is that they have to be comfortable, right? Like everything I just mentioned is great, but if they're not comfortable to sleep on, you're not going to use them. And I'm happy to report that these sheets are insanely comfortable. They're just as nice, if not nicer, than sheets that I've slept on in 5-star hotels, but without the high price tag. So they're smooth, they're breathable, and they're insanely comfortable. They're also great for your skin. All that hidden bacteria that you find in regular sheets, it can clog your pores, it can cause breakouts, and nobody wants any of that, but with Miracle Made's antibacterial design, it helps you sleep cleaner and clearer night after night. So upgrade your sleep or give the gift of better rest by going to trymiracle.com/detective to try Miracle Made Sheets today. You'll save over 40%, and when you use my promo code DETECTIVE, you'll get an extra 20% off plus a free 3-piece towel set, which makes an amazing gift. Plus, on top of all that, there's a 30-day money-back guarantee, so there's really no risk. Once again, if you want to check it out, that's trymiracle.com/detective at checkout. Thanks to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. All right, we're back. And so Patty finally calls Larry, and Larry tells Patty that he and Erica had gotten into a huge argument at his apartment in the early morning hours of February 15th. According to him, Erica left and drove off, and he said he didn't know what had happened to her after that. She asked what they had fought about, and Larry said he couldn't recall. Erica's sister would later tell Kendall Ray that this response was extremely surprising because in the past, when Larry and Erica argued, he would call Patty and say that they had gotten into a fight and Erica was going back home. But this time, he didn't call. He waited until Patty reached out to him. And that was the deviation for her, where this is not the common pattern of behavior displayed in the past, which indicates to her that maybe something different happened here. Maybe the outcome of Erica just deciding to leave and go back home wasn't an option here, and that was the reason why Larry decided not to call her. And I agree with her assessment here. Yes, it could be an outlier, but the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. So when we have data, we have samples of a previous argument that got out of hand where Erica decided to leave, she would leave, but yet Larry would still call Patty and say, hey, she's on her way home. So it's reasonable to ask why he didn't do that here. And as we get into the story and talk about the outcome, it's going to make more sense why she's questioning his behavior on this particular occasion. Maybe during this particular argument, the outcome, the ending, if you will, wasn't the same as it had been in the past. So throughout February 15th, Patty continued making calls, hoping that someone had seen or heard from Erica, but just like earlier, no one had. Nobody knew where she was. Nobody had spoken to her. So when Erica failed to show up at work on February 16th, she was officially reported missing. And detectives immediately began checking to see if her phone, credit cards, or social media accounts had been accessed after the early morning hours of February 15th, and none of them had. So as you would expect, detectives then turned their attention to speaking with Larry. And he said that Erica drove to his apartment, located near Culver Drive and Deerfield Avenue in Irvine, on the night of February 14th. From there, the two Ubered to the Sutra Lounge, located in Costa Mesa. And we do have some photos from that night, some video footage, where you can see Larry and Erica at this establishment. According to Larry, at around 1:30 a.m., they accepted a ride home from a couple they had met at the bar, and he said the couple came inside his apartment to continue the party and stayed for a few hours. At around 3:45 a.m., the couple left. Larry told detectives that 10 to 15 minutes after the couple took off, he and Erica got into an argument. He said she stormed out, got into her car, and drove away. He claimed he had not seen or heard from her since. According to CBS, when detectives pressed Larry for more details, including what the argument was about, he told them as well that he could not remember. And keep in context here, this is only a few days, maybe a week later. You have someone that you're dating, you got into this huge argument with her, she's nowhere to be found, and you don't remember the last conversation you had with her. You don't recall what the argument was about. Even if he's lying, you would think that he would have come up with something, right? If he already knows what happened to her, why not just lie and say, you know, the argument was because I was flirting with the other person, you know, that was there, or I had made a comment that embarrassed her, just something to not look as suspicious as this does. But yet he's not telling Patty, he's not even telling law enforcement, and you have to ask yourself why. So after speaking with Larry, detectives worked to corroborate his account of what happened that night, and they started in the apartment complex. They looked for Erica's vehicle, which was a white 2014 Honda Civic, which was no longer there. They also searched for surveillance footage as well, but as far as we know, they did not locate any usable video. So it seems like just another case, 2015, not that long ago, and yet no camera in the right place at the right time. So we're left wondering what happened. If they just had one surveillance camera there, maybe at the exit or entry of that facility, we may know more about what happened to Erica. So I can, you know, preach from the rooftops. I don't understand how these establishments aren't legally required at this point to have that type of surveillance footage, but yet here we are in 2026 and it's still not the case. However, even though they weren't able to get surveillance footage from the apartment complex, as I mentioned quickly earlier, they did locate surveillance footage at the Sutra Lounge. And in that footage, detectives were able to confirm that Erica and Luke did in fact leave the bar with a couple that had been driving a red Toyota Scion FRS. So this is great, right? We have a very strong lead and two additional people that we can talk to that may know where Erica is. And that's exactly what investigators tried to do. They tried to find this couple so that they could question them, but unfortunately, they were unable to identify them. So, 2 days after Erica disappeared, authorities went to the public. They shared Larry's account and stated that Erica had last been seen leaving his apartment at approximately 4 a.m. on February 15th, and they asked anyone who had seen Erica or her vehicle to come forward with any information they had. Detectives also said they were attempting to identify and locate the couple who had given Erica and Larry a ride home that evening, and their pictures were released to the media as well. And this is great, right? You got to give credit where credit's due. We've talked about a lot of investigations in the past where law enforcement will choose an alternate route and they'll keep this information internal and try to locate themselves. And it'll be weeks, months, even years before they release this information, and now it's stale and they get nowhere. But here, investigators checked their egos at the door, realized how important it was to identify these people as soon as possible, and went out to the public and asked for help. And that's exactly what you should do. And if you do it many times, it's going to pay off. And that's exactly what happened here. Because the following day on February 20th, the couple came forward. Look at that. Now, NBC reported that the couple was questioned separately and at length, and their stories matched. They told detectives that they had befriended Erica and Larry at the bar and driven them back to Larry's apartment. While inside the apartment, Erica and Larry began arguing in another room, and the couple couldn't hear what the argument was about, but they felt uncomfortable, and they left at around 3:45 a.m. And according to them, they had not seen or heard from Erica since then. And although their stories mostly matched, I think it's important to point out that if you remember what Larry told investigators, he said that the couple left and then they fought. So we have a discrepancy here, and either it's a misremembering of what happened that night, which I find very doubtful, or the stories aren't lining up. Something's not computing here where Larry's not telling the truth, or the couple's not telling the truth, or they didn't get their stories right. So it's something to consider here, because even though it's close, it's not perfect. And when you're looking to solve a case, you have to look for those minor discrepancies. And again, it could just be an oversight. But with something like this that's so important, and everybody involved knows the significance of these interviews, they're going to try to be as accurate as possible. So having this slight deviation, I think, is very critical to this case. After speaking with the couple, authorities addressed the public again. They said the couple had been cleared and that Erica's case was being treated as a missing person investigation. There was no sign of foul play and that they were not looking at her disappearance as a crime. Detectives further stated that they believed Erica left Larry's apartment with her vehicle as he stated. They said Larry had been cooperative and that they could not label him a suspect or a person of interest. According to police, everything he told them checked out. And I do have to say here that, you know, doing the research for this case, we've seen some of the comments online, and a lot of people find this statement by law enforcement ridiculous, and I have to agree with them. I understand saying that parts of Larry's story up to this point have checked out and that parts of the couple's story up to this point have checked out, but we already know that there was no surveillance footage at the apartment complex. So how do we know for certain that Erica left in her own vehicle under her own free will? We don't. It's an unanswered question. There's a question mark over that spot in this case. Nobody has been able to answer it to this day. And if they do have that answer, they haven't given it to us publicly. They haven't said, hey, here's a surveillance footage showing Erica get into her car and leave the apartment by herself under her own power. If they had it, they would have given it to us. So you can say, yeah, there are parts of Larry's story up to this point that track. But unfortunately, there's just certain things that we can't corroborate. There's certain things we can't confirm. That would have been okay. I can tell you what I wouldn't have done. I wouldn't have gone to the extent of clearing the couple or saying that we could not label Larry a suspect or person of interest, because it's also true that you could not name him a suspect or person of interest. You see what I'm saying there? There's not enough information. So by putting that out there, it gives a public perception that he's been completely cleared. You know, he can be cooperative and still be not telling the truth. So I wouldn't have gone there. So I disagree with that decision. And I agree with a lot of the online community that could have been handled differently, which may have helped in this case, because certain people might have listened to that or read that and said, oh, yeah, Larry's good and this couple's good. Starting from ground zero, somebody else must be involved. And that's just not the case. And I'm not sitting here saying that the couple did it or Larry did it. It's obviously a possibility, and we're going to talk about that. I'm just saying, as far as I'm concerned, and if I'm looking at this as a chessboard, all the pieces are still in play. So the search for Erica and her car continued, and on March 25th, her vehicle was located near Cedarbrook and Redwood in Aliso Viejo. And I have to tell you, Aliso Viejo, it took me probably 20 tries before I got that right. So I really hope I got the pronunciation, and if I didn't, you guys can crush me in the comments. But that's the best I got. And just for context, this location was approximately 10 miles from Luke's apartment and about 1 mile from Erica's home. The media reported that there was no visible damage to the vehicle and no immediate signs of foul play. However, there was a thin layer of dust on the exterior and 2 parking tickets had been issued, so the vehicle had clearly been there for an extended period of time. And when detectives searched the car, they found Erica's purse sitting in plain view with money still inside, and the only item missing was her phone. That phone, to this day, has never been recovered. Now, as far as the rest of the search of Erica's vehicle, it's unclear what else, if anything, was found in the car, because all detectives have ever said was they found, quote, no useful evidence, which isn't very useful. So there's not much we can look at there, but there is a couple things that I mentioned we can discuss, right? First and foremost, the purse with money found inside the vehicle. So that would suggest that Erica had been in the car before it was parked there, and yet no phone. So that means at minimum it was on her person. It also brings into question the theory as to whether or not she was in the car at all. If she had the phone on her, maybe somebody else was driving the car, and that's why they have never found the phone. And if someone else was driving that vehicle, now you have to start to wonder about who that person would have been. You would think, based on the close proximity to her apartment, that it would be someone who had a familiarity with Erica and her life, and that they would know the vehicle being close to the apartment would at least give the indication that maybe she was on her way home. Then you have to ask the question, why wouldn't they just go all the way there? Why wouldn't they park at the apartment complex? My first question would be, are there cameras? I don't have those answers, only the investigators would and people from that area. But there is also maybe a concern that if this person knew Erica and had been at her apartment before, maybe someone there, an eyewitness, might recognize them dropping off her vehicle. And that would obviously blow up whatever they're trying to do. So that could be potentially another reason why this person got very close to Erica's apartment, but didn't go all the way there. They were concerned about being spotted. Another theory that you have to at least mention, or you're not doing your job, is that maybe while Erica was driving home, she was upset and just couldn't go the extra mile, so decided to pull over and park the car and collect her thoughts and kind of get herself together. And while doing so, someone approached her vehicle and maybe presented themselves as a friendly and took advantage of the situation. And I already know what a lot of you are thinking, and trust me, I'm thinking the same thing. If you got a 10-mile drive home and you're already upset about the argument, why would you stop 1 mile from your house and just park in a parking lot? Why wouldn't you go the extra mile, get home, get inside, and cry or yell or scream or whatever you got to do? That would be the most reasonable expectation. And I think that 99.9% of the time, that's what everyone would do. But I bring it up just to be fair and impartial, right? I don't automatically want to paint the picture that Erica wasn't driving the car and someone who knew her was. This case hasn't been solved as far as what happened to her and who might be involved. So we have to explore all scenarios. So with Erica's car being located, many people thought she'd be found soon, but it'd take over a month before that happened. On April 27th, a group of biologists were working in a remote area of Orange County, about 1 mile east of the fire ranger station on Ortega Highway near Hot Springs Road, when they discovered a decomposing body in a dry creek bed. And just for context, this location was approximately 31 miles from Luke's apartment and 20 miles from where Erica's car had been found. When detectives arrived at the scene, they determined that the body belonged to a woman. She was found in the fetal position, wrapped in plastic bags and duct tape. Now, here's the interesting part. You might think this is going to come as a complete surprise to everyone close to Erica, right? Why would she be 20 miles away from where her car was found, right? Well, Erica's family learned that the body had been discovered in that area, and they automatically feared that it could be hers. Why, you might ask? Well, when they were speaking to Kendall Ray, they said that they had actually searched that area for Erica because Larry was known to ride his motorcycle there. So it was already on their radar. So the remains were transported for autopsy and were quickly identified as Erica Alonzo. Her family's worst fear had come true, and they were absolutely devastated. According to Erica's family, based on the level of decomposition, authorities did not think that Erica had been in that creek bed the entire time she was missing. But no further details were released. But we can kind of read between the lines there, right? They believe that whatever happened to Erica, she was at a primary location first, and then her body was later moved to the secondary location. Pretty self-explanatory. And authorities initially told Erica's family that there were no obvious signs of trauma and no clear indication of how Erica died. However, Erica's family later received the autopsy report, and they learned that she had several bruises, including one measuring 5 by 4 inches on the right side of her skull. And they were shocked to learn this, so they asked for a second autopsy, but were denied. Toxicology testing was also requested to learn more, but the results would take months, and at that point, there was no official cause or manner of death. Despite that, many believed Erica had been killed, and public suspicion focused heavily on Larry. Erica's family told the media that they were frustrated Larry would not speak with them and did not attend Erica's funeral. They believed he might have answers, but because he was not communicating, they were left in the dark. They also tried to speak with the couple from the bar, but according to the family, they wouldn't talk either. So with nobody willing to speak to Erica's family, they were basically left wondering, how the hell did Erica get from Luke's place to being found miles away, wrapped in bags and duct tape? To a lot of people, it seems only obvious that people would think Larry was somehow involved, but according to the police, that's not the case. Detectives told ABC7 that they had investigated Larry, and that, again, his story checked out, and he was not considered a suspect. However, I do want to note that Erica's family said shortly after Erica's body was found, Larry retained an attorney, and he also moved out of his home. And I want to unpack that a little bit. First off, if I'm looking at this objectively, I do understand why Larry would not want to speak to the family and would not attend the funeral and would also retain an attorney and move out of his place. Let's just say, for the sake of this argument, he's not involved. He knows that a lot of people out there thinks that he is. And so he's not going to speak to them because he knows the more he says, the more trouble he could get in. And more than likely, no matter what he says, they're not going to completely believe him anyways. And then if he goes to the funeral, now he becomes the topic of conversation and there could be something that goes down there, which takes away from why the family's actually there. And then after Erica's body's found, again, he knows that he's someone law enforcement may still be looking at, even though they're saying publicly he's not a suspect. So he does the right thing and he gets a lawyer, and maybe out of fear that someone could retaliate against him, even if it's just some vigilante, he moves out of his place. When you look at it from that perspective, I get it. Whether he's involved or not, it makes sense. If he's involved, it makes perfect sense, right? He's not going to say anything that could incriminate himself and get him jammed up, and he doesn't want to look at these people in the eye because he knows they're going to know. They're going to know something went down. On the other hand, if he had nothing to do with it, all of it still makes sense. So I wouldn't look too much into this. It doesn't necessarily scream guilty or not guilty to me. From whatever side you approach it, it makes sense. And we're not done here. We still have more to cover. We still have to talk about the toxicology reports because they're going to be a big factor in this case. And we're going to talk about them right after the break. We've all gone through rough patches, right? Maybe a breakup, burnout, or even just that creeping anxiety that doesn't let you sleep. And you're laying there thinking, I wish I had someone to talk to who actually gets it. I've definitely been there more than once, and I've seen how powerful therapy can be, not only for me, but for my friends, for my family, and for the people close to me that were really struggling and needed help. But let's be honest, getting access to the right therapist can be a nightmare. You call around and people aren't taking new clients, they're not in your network, or it costs a fortune, and that's where Rula comes in. Rula is really changing the game. They make high-quality mental health care accessible and affordable, and most people pay only $15 a session, and they take most major insurance. All you have to do is answer a few quick questions, and you're matched with a licensed professional who meets your preferences, and you can be talking to someone as soon as the next day. And with Rula, there's over 15,000 therapists and psychiatrists in their network, so they really do have a plethora of people to choose from. And one of the best things about Rula is they don't leave you hanging after that. They actually stay with you, checking in on your progress and making sure you're getting what you need out of therapy. Whether it's a therapist or even a psychiatrist to help with medication management, Rula has you covered. So if you've been thinking about therapy, or even if this is the first time you're considering it, this is your sign. Thousands of people have already used Rula to finally get the care they needed, so don't keep pushing it off. Head over to rula.com/detective to get started today. Once again, that's rula.com/detective. Take the first step, get connected, and take control of your mental health. Cravings aren't just about nicotine, they're about habit. That hand-to-mouth motion, oral fixation, the momentary pause. When that loop is broken, cravings spike, and Fume replaces that habit with a flavored air fidget device that gives your hands and mouth something to do, distracting cravings without nicotine, vapor, or batteries. So don't just quit. Upgrade the habit loop and reach for Fume instead. If you haven't already heard on this channel before, Fume is a flavored air device designed to help people quit smoking and vaping by breaking the hand-to-mouth pattern. Again, as I just said, no nicotine, no batteries, no vapor, just clean, natural flavors in a fidget-friendly design that actually feels good to use. And this is also something I mentioned numerous times. I love the design of this thing. Matches my desk, if you haven't already noticed. Real wood, real metal. I'm someone who always has something in my hand while recording here or just working in general. And if you're paying close attention, you'll see me playing with it and you might even hear it, even though I try to keep it away from the mic. But we have the magnets. That's what I use the most. There's also a little bit of a fidget device there, the clicking. Pretty cool as well. But it's not only about how it looks or how it feels in your hand. It also has to taste good, right? My personal favorite is orange vanilla. That's been my go-to since day one. Maybe it's because that's the first flavor I tried. You know, I don't know, but I really like it. They also have flavors like crisp mint and raspberry, so a ton of flavors to choose from depending on what you like. And now is the perfect time to try Fume, because when you grab your journey pack, they'll also give you a free gift just for using my code DETECTIVE. Fume has already helped over 700,000 people take steps toward better habits, and now it's your turn. So use my code DETECTIVE to get a free gift with your journey pack. So head over to tryfume.com, that's T-R-Y-F-U-M.com, and use my code DETECTIVE to claim your free gift today. All right, we're back from break, and as I mentioned, I want to talk about these toxicology reports because they're a massive part of this case. So months after Erica was found, the toxicology results finally came back, and they show that Erica's blood alcohol content was 0.22, nearly three times the legal limit, and that she also had a lethal dose of GHB in her system. Now, based on those findings, the coroner ruled that Erica's cause of death was an overdose. However, her manner of death was listed as undetermined. In a press release, officials vaguely explained their decision, stating, quote, based on the totality of the investigation, including interviews, evidence collection, autopsy, and toxicology results, investigators do not believe Erica was a victim of a homicide. Authorities have never really elaborated or provided any more insight into that determination. The only piece of information comes from something detectives told NBC. They said that while GHB is sometimes known as a date rape drug, quote, it's also utilized, for lack of better terms, as a party drug. It gives a sedative, euphoric type feeling. So basically what detectives were saying is that Erica drank and did GHB willingly, and because of the amount she had in her system, she accidentally overdosed and died, and therefore she was not killed. So following that announcement, Erica's father, Isaac, told CBS that the overdose determination came as a surprise to the entire family. He said, quote, we were not expecting something like that. It's hard to believe because she didn't do heavy drugs. He added that his daughter's cause of death, quote, raises more questions for the family. He said, quote, somebody did this and we need to find out why they would try to get rid of the body. If they knew what was happening, they could call 911 and ask for help or something, And they didn't do that. Now, I'm going to talk about this more in my perspective, but I just want to put out there that there have been some rumors that Sutro Lounge was kind of like a swingers lounge. So you do have to ask the question, you know, did Erica and Larry go there to meet another couple? And that was kind of the plan all along. And, you know, maybe they went back to the apartment and maybe they all voluntarily took a little something to kind of enhance the mood. But again, I'm going to talk about that as a potential theory in the final perspective. But that is something worth noting to you guys. Again, don't know if it's true or not. Maybe somebody from the area can confirm or deny this. But Sutro Lounge apparently was known as a place where swingers would frequent, just from what I've heard. And so you have these questions about that. And then you also have questions about how she drove away from Luke's place if she was three times over the limit and on a lethal dose of GHB. Doesn't seem likely. And I have talked to some people, and I'm not going to say names, but people who have personally been under the influence of GHB, and they said in their experience, it would be absolutely impossible for her to drive that vehicle. If anybody cares to share stories in the comments that may shed some light on that, I'd love to hear them. By the end of July 2015, detectives acknowledged that there were still major unanswered questions in Erica's case. They did not know how Erica's body ended up in this remote area, who may have placed her there, how long she had been there, or even her manner of death. They said, quote, "What happened after she died is still essentially a mystery." Detectives also shared that the case was still being investigated, but at that time, it was not being handled as a homicide. And there's a simple explanation for this. There's multiple charges in California: concealment of a body, destruction of evidence. These are still crimes that someone committed, right? Someone dumped Erica's body in this remote area, and they packaged her up in these bags and duct tape. So you have multiple misdemeanors here, and they have to find that person. They owe that to Erica and her family. So I think that's what they're saying here. That's what I'm reading between the lines. But I want to fast forward to the next major update, which came in 2016. This was when the Orange County Sheriff's Department told People magazine that they still did not have the answers they wanted. However, detectives would continue to monitor the case in the hopes of one day finding out who is responsible. I also want to note that Erica's family stated that investigators informed them that there was one person of interest, though no name has ever been publicly released. In the years since 2016, there have been no major public updates from law enforcement, but Erica's family continues to push for answers. Today, more than 11 years after Erica's death, they continue to advocate for a full and thorough investigation. They have made it very clear they will not stop fighting until they have answers. All right, let's dive into this perspective. And we talked about a lot tonight, but I have more I want to elaborate on. I really wanted to discuss three potential theories, and there's a lot more than that. There's probably 10, but I'm gonna focus on the three that I think are at the top of the list. I'm gonna start with the least likely though, because I want to get that one out of the way, and that's the possibility that somehow Erica did get into her vehicle that night after being on GHB and drinking, and decided, "I'm leaving. I'm going home." And somehow, as she was driving home, and I talked about this theory a little bit in the episode, she gets very close to her house, and just the GHB at this point is, and the alcohol is just too much. So she pulls over because she's not feeling well and she's upset, and maybe she falls asleep, or maybe someone comes up to her to check on her. Something happens where she ends up with someone else, someone who we have yet to identify. And this person may have initially presented themselves as someone who was trying to help, and something went wrong. Something went wrong, whether it was intentional or accidental, and this person took advantage of the situation. And eventually, that's how Erica ended up being found in the dry creek bed 20 miles away. Do I think this is what happened? I don't. Is it possible? Yes, I have to sit here and acknowledge that it is a possibility. I don't have anything to rule it out definitively, but it's highly unlikely. I don't see why, if Erica was able to get basically 1 mile from the house, she wouldn't have gone that one extra mile. I personally don't think that she would have been able to drive the car at all, just from based on what I've heard from other people. I've never been under the influence of GHB, thankfully, but I've been around people who have, and Like I said, we had someone involved with this case who had personal experience with it, unfortunately. And they said, yeah, no shot. No shot she could have driven home. Add on to that, that she was a .22. So in my opinion, I just don't think she would have been physically capable of driving the vehicle, which makes this whole theory of her encountering someone else highly unlikely. Which brings us to the second theory, which is that there is some truth to what the couple and Larry have told us up to this point, that they went to the bar, they came back home, and whether it was voluntary or it was done without Erica knowing, she was under GHB. And they had been arguing, and the couple decided to leave because it went from being a good time to uncomfortable. So they leave, and then it's just Larry and Erica behind. And maybe they're arguing because Erica didn't want to go through with what Larry wanted, and the couple realized that she wasn't okay with it, so they decided to leave. And the GHB, which she had been given a lethal dose of, finally took hold of her, and she OD'd on it. And instead of calling 911 or calling her family or friends, Larry just left her there. And then realizing that she couldn't be found in his home, he had to do something. And what happened after that? It's all speculation. It's all conjecture. I would think he would have had to have had some type of help based on where the car was found. But my initial thought would be he gets rid of the car so that he can say she wasn't with him when whatever happened, right? You have to do that. If the car is still found at his apartment complex, you're going to expect Erica to be found there as well. So he's got to get rid of the car, and he knows where she lives, but he can't deliver it to her house. So he parks it close by, and however he gets back to his apartment, he gets back. And Erica, at that point, because he can't drive 20, 30 miles away to this creek bed where he's familiar with the area right then and there, he puts her body somewhere else for a short time. And then when the coast is clear, he moves it out to the secondary location that he's familiar with and dumps her body there. And you know there's something going on here because, as I mentioned in the episode, you have conflicting stories, right? You have the couple saying that they were arguing before they left. You have him saying that the argument started afterward. So someone's off. Someone's off here, and you have to ask yourself whether it's intentional or accidental. However, when we get into this third and final theory, if it's right, then this was accidental, but on behalf of both of them. What do I mean by that? Well, the third scenario is very similar to the second with a slight change. Let's say the couple and Larry and Erica all decide to go back to the apartment. And while they're there, either they slip something in Erica's drink or they're all kind of experimenting, doing, you know, a little bit of drugs and alcohol. And while they're all there at, you know, early morning hours, something happens. Erica ODs. She has a bad reaction to what they're taking, and they realize, oh God, this is bad. And again, just like scenario number two, they collectively decide not to call 911 for whatever reason. Maybe they feel that because they're doing these illegal drugs and it's going to come back on them, they can't call the police. They can't call the fire department, which is absolutely ludicrous, but I've seen dumber shit done. So it's possible where they were like, nope, we can't call anybody because it's going to come back on us, especially if they gave Erica the drugs without her knowing. So they're all there. She ODs. She passes away. And at that point, they realize that they have to get rid of her body. They got to get out of that location. And they also have to move the car. So at that point, Larry takes the car and he drives it to this location where it's eventually found. The couple, or one of them, brings him back. And then they put Erica's body in a primary location for the time being. And then just like in scenario number two, eventually the body is moved out to this dry creek bed, which Larry's familiar with, right? Who moves it, when they move it, I don't know. We don't have those answers. But I say all this to say, if that had happened, then them giving conflicting stories is because they worked out the details of what they were going to say, except for this minor detail, which you would think would be insignificant and probably wouldn't be something that was asked. But because they were interviewed separately, you had Larry say, oh yeah, the argument happened after they left. And they said, oh no, it happened before. Because that was one thing they hadn't cross-referenced. That was one thing that they didn't dot their I's on. So we were able to pick up on it. This is a story that was fabricated, and one minor detail wasn't planned out. And maybe that's why the stories are off. So in this case, they're both lying. That's why it's not lining up. And let me just add a little bit more fuel to that fire, right? Because if Larry was lying, or if the couple was lying, you would think that we would have heard one of the two parties coming out and saying, oh no, Larry's wrong. The fight was definitely happening before we left. Or conversely, Larry coming out and saying, I don't know why the couple would have said that. We were fine when they were there. They left and then we started arguing. And also, Larry would be able to tell you what the argument was about. The fact that both parties have not said what it's about, again, another detail that at least Larry should know that nobody's willing to put forward, because again, that part of the story wasn't vetted between both parties, so they're refusing to say anything. And then the final little wrinkle here that gives me pause about this couple, and I'm not saying they're involved, they're innocent until proven guilty, but the one thing that I struggle with is that they weren't willing to speak with Erica's family. I gave you a reason why Larry wouldn't be willing to speak with the family, and you could make an argument that they feel the same way, that Erica's family is going to blame them, but if they did exactly what they said they did and they left before anything got out of hand, why wouldn't you sit down with the family and say, hey, I just want you to know our condolences. We're willing to help you any way we can to make sure you get answers about your daughter. Here's what happened while we were there. Here's what we heard. Here's what we didn't hear. This is what happened. And this was the situation when we left. The fact that they haven't been willing to speak with them, it could be just a personal choice. They just don't want to get involved. Or potentially it's because they don't want to trip up and say something that could get them in trouble. They don't know what Erica's family already knows, and they don't know what potentially Larry may have told people that they know. So the only way to not trip themselves up is to not say anything at all. But even with all those theories, one thing that I'm sure some of you picked up on, I never suggested that either party killed Erica intentionally. Is it possible that they gave her GHB without her knowing, and then that could be a more significant crime? Absolutely. Would be very hard to prove. What we do know is that Erica had a bad reaction to the drugs, and more than likely at least one person that I've mentioned tonight was present, and they did nothing about it except for protect themselves after the fact. So we have to get those answers. How do we do it? If they haven't already done it, check cell phone records, check more cameras, interview witnesses. I would even go as far as interviewing friends and associates of not only Larry, but this couple. What are some of the questions I would ask? What are they into? Do they swing? Do they do couple sharing? Have they ever experimented with drugs in their presence? I would develop a profile on all three of these individuals. I would want to know what they were into before February 15th, 2015. Did they ever frequent the Sutra or any other nightclub where they met up with a couple and went back to their place? Did they ever experiment with GHB or any other drugs? These are all things that you could go to these different bars and different hangout spots and see if the couple or Larry had been there, and try to find people who may have interacted with them at one point or another. If any of them come back and say, yeah, I actually partied with them and we experimented with this drug, or yeah, I was with them one time and after they left, I got sick and we found out later that I had actually been given GHB. Maybe this has already been done, but if it hasn't, it needs to be, because that could get the ball rolling to try to figure out what actually happened that night and why it appears at least that people aren't being forthright. But everything I just said right now, what does it come down to? You, people out there who are from that area, who may have information that they don't even know they have yet, but by covering this case and hearing about it, maybe something pops up in your head and you go, you know what? I remember that, or I know those people, or I've been to that establishment. That's the point of continuing to talk about it. I want to reinvigorate this case, and I want to make sure that everyone from that area knows Erica Alonzo's name. So just to recap, 27-year-old Erica Alonzo was last seen in the early morning hours of February 15th, 2015 at her ex-boyfriend's home in Irvine, California. She was later found wrapped in plastic bags and duct tape in a remote area off Ortega Highway. Her cause of death was ruled an overdose, and her manner of death was listed as undetermined. Anyone with information in Erica's case is asked to call the Orange County Crime Stoppers at 855-847-6227 or visit occrimestoppers.org. My final words, as always, go out to Erica's friends and family. Listen, there's one thing we know for sure. Erica didn't bring herself out to this remote area and tie herself up with bags and duct tape. Someone did that. Someone made the conscious effort to cover up what happened to her. The question is why. And in order to find that out, we have to identify the who. And I'm hoping that someone out there listening or watching right now is able to do that for us. And if that happens, I'll be right here letting all of you guys know. But until then, everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you soon.